Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes Walter Isaacson, author of the acclaimed bestsellers Steve Jobs, Einstein, and Benjamin Franklin. Now Isaacson brings to life history's most creative genius, Leonardo da Vinci, in an exciting new biography based on da Vinci's astonishing notebooks and new discoveries about his life and work. Hosted by the Church of the Redeemer at 5603 North Charles Street on Saturday, October 21st. Doors open at 7 p.m. with the program beginning at 7:30. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966.
Hello for the 311th time. From the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rodericks. And this is Roughly Speaking, episode 311, for Thursday, October 19th, 2017. Today on the show, Brian Klass is a fellow in comparative politics at the London School of Economics and a man who watches closely the behavior of dictators and despots around the world. Recognizing and understanding authoritarianism is his specialty. He's written a couple of books on the subject, The Despot's Accomplice, which argued that too many Western democracies were supporting anti-democratic regimes for short-term political or economic gain, making the world less stable and less democratic. And now, a new book from Brian Klass being published this month, The Despot's Apprentice, Donald Trump's Attack on Democracy. Brian Klass is a prolific commentator on politics in the Trump era, and his tweets are among the most biting and trenchant you'll see in your daily feed. I thought you'd like to hear what he has to say. Ronald Reagan, the 40th president of the United States, said, "Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction." And while few Americans will say they view the 45th president as a despot or dictator, Brian Klass believes Trump has shown those tendencies, frequently criticizing the press and threatening to use government to shut down a TV network, tweeting personal attacks or twisted facts or outright lies, putting family members on the White House staff, signing executive orders of dubious legality and of potentially draconian impact, filling his cabinet with people inexperienced in government or highly skeptical of its role in the life of the nation, sending mixed messages about leaders of some of the world's worst regimes. These are certainly strange times, and while it might seem extreme to think of Trump or any president destroying our democracy, Brian Klass says the warning signs are there. Fresh off the news, I have to ask you, Brian, are you heartened at all that a federal judge, a U.S. District Court judge, has held up the latest version of the Trump travel ban, saying that it's in conflict with U.S. law?
Yes, I am heartened, and I think this is indicative of the fact that there are still robust checks and balances in American democracy, and that the founders did a very good job in anticipating somebody like Trump. But I'm not as worried about the collapse of formal institutions as much as the erosion of political attitudes among the electorate. So I think somebody like Trump, who continually violates democratic norms, which I refer to as the soft guardrails of democracy, is going to do damage in how the American public perceives democratic institutions and that slow death of them, as opposed to, you know, some sort of power grab or any sort of real authoritarianism. And so, you know, this attitude where you have a sizable percentage of the American population believe that we should ban Muslims, as polling suggests in response to Trump's 2015 suggestion that we do so, is really worrying for democracy. You have a Senate candidate in Alabama who's getting endorsed by mainstream Republicans who said we should ban Muslims from serving in Congress. So, you know, you can still damage democracy even if there is formal pushback from institutions, and I think that's what we're seeing under the Trump presidency so far.
Well, that was the question I had for you after reading excerpts of your book, the latest book. Do people want democracy? With increasing fears of globalism, international terrorism, a rise in nativism that we've seen in the West, including here in the U.S. now with Trump, there's evidence that people might prefer authoritarian rule, heavy-handed big-boot government, the desire to blow up what Steve Bannon calls the deep state.
So there is a worrying and growing number of people who are willing to accept alternatives to representative democracy. There's a Pew Research survey out this week that shows 15 to 25% accepting things like military rule and also strongman rule in the United States. So that should be raising a serious number of red flags. But I think that any sort of attitudes that favor that view haven't lived, those people haven't lived in authoritarian countries. And I have spent a considerable amount of time living in authoritarian places, and I can tell you, it is not just a terrible place to be a dissident. I mean, I've interviewed countless torture victims, people who have lost family members or friends, journalists who have been arrested, etc., for just speaking truth to power in authoritarian countries. But it's also that authoritarianism over the long term produces catastrophic economic outcomes, political collapse. It doesn't have creativity because you can't speak or think in creative ways. And so I think this newfound fascination with a segment of the population with alternatives to democracy is born out of the fact that they haven't seen anything else, and then they've taken for granted what democracy is. So you see, particularly among young people, more people willing to say that they don't think that democracy is essential, for example, whereas people who lived through the Second World War are extremely keen on ensuring that democracy survives because they've seen the horrors of totalitarianism. Now, that's totally separate from a different point, which is that democracy has been failing a lot of people, and that is tied up much more to economics than to political functioning. Mm-hmm. So that's the fact that we've had, you know, for the 25-year period between 1935 and 1960, and then the 25-year period from 1960 to 1985, the median voter's quality of life in America doubled in both of those periods. And in the 25 years since that, it stagnated completely. So, you know, people have been feeling like they're let down by a system that is more polarized than ever before since at least, you know, the Civil War, and where Democrats and Republicans don't see eye to eye just on basic facts, let alone the direction of the country. And so I think that that is a, you know, a canary in the coal mine for the ailing health of American democracy. And Trump is a symptom of that, certainly. But it doesn't mean that you should destroy democracy, because I can tell you it is much, much worse is the alternative,
right,
and much more damaging and scary to imagine those alternatives. So I think that this should be something that's a wake-up call to fix democracy as opposed to abandoning it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very easy for me to believe what you say. I'm something of a student of history. I pay attention. I'm in the news business. Other people may look at our democracy and say it's a big mess. They look at gridlock in Congress, for instance, and say it's a big mess, or they don't feel like government serves them, so they assume it's a big mess and that Bannon is correct. We should blow up this so-called deep state of administrative government.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned the deep state again, because the deep state, the term in its origins comes from Turkey, Egypt, and Pakistan, places where the real deep state in those countries goes through false flag operations, assassinates political opponents, frames people for terrorist attacks. That doesn't happen in the United States. And so I think this hyperbole that has now crept into our political culture is exactly the kind of counterproductive rhetoric that tries to conflate democratic failures with authoritarianism. And in fact, it lays the groundwork for much more insidious abuses of democracy to take place if people think that, for example, the Congressional Budget Office, which has been called a deep state organism by people like Newt Gingrich, are painted in these sinister tones. These are nerds with spreadsheets who provide nonpartisan, independent budget analysis so that we can make informed decisions about policy. And now all of a sudden they're being lumped in as though they're part of this shadowy, sinister government operation like you might see in Turkey or Egypt. And it's crazy. I mean, it's fundamentally crazy to see this type of language creep into the United States. And it's very odd for me personally, because my expertise, I worked in American politics on campaigns before I did my PhD, and then I left American politics because I figured I'm more interested in authoritarianism and authoritarian populism. And now I've come back to it because it's crept into the United States, stuff where I'm seeing parallels from behavior, rhetoric, polarization in places of the world that are dysfunctional. And so, you know, I am genuinely worried about it. The people who have these attitudes that think we need to blow up the deep state are absolutely misdiagnosing the problem.
Hmm.
And they're putting blame on government bureaucrats who are doing their job and functioning as part of a liberal democracy. So, you know, you can try to say that policy failures are serious, serious challenges, and there's no question about that. I mean, inequality has been soaring in the United States for the last three decades, and rural America has been dying. So I can understand why people would be angry. But if you try to live under a military dictatorship or an authoritarian state like in Belarus, where I've done some work, I can tell you it's much, much worse. And so, you know, the inequality, the lack of a voice, all those things we take for granted in America can go away. And so, you know, I think if those people understood that the governments in authoritarian societies just abduct and torture people, they suppress the truth, the media is not free, they have propaganda exclusively, all those things, you know, that they overshadow completely this idea that America has anything like this simply because the Congressional Budget Office or the FBI is making decisions that a certain segment of the population disagrees with.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about communications and the way Trump has attacked the media, the news media. Now, to some, it may just sound like another president complaining about bad press, but Trump has taken it further than that. And we have this president talking about fake news and accusing mainstream news organizations of making up stories and being the enemy of the people. So there's two things here that I wanted to talk about. One is why the press or the news media is held in low regard in the United States, because I think that's why Trump is using this, because he looks at polls, he says, well, people don't regard the press very highly anyway, so I might as well beat up on them.
Okay, so I think there's two issues here. One is why the press is unpopular, and the other is why is Trump demonizing them.
Yeah.
So the reason why I think the press is unpopular is because it's an outgrowth of polarization in the society and political polarization. So we have an explosion of a menu of media options in the last three decades. You had a much narrower menu to choose from in, say, the 1960s when people would be watching television news, right, on CBS, ABC, NBC. Now you can go on everything from InfoWars to Fox News, MSNBC, internet websites that often are not credible, et cetera. And that creates more polarization. So the expansion of media options has allowed people to self-select into partisan echo chambers, which then expands on polarization. And then when you try to be objective in that context, everyone is unhappy with you. Because very few people consider themselves to be centrist these days. So trying to have some sort of centrist attitude or centrist portrayal of facts makes everybody loathe you, because very few people occupy that sort of political ground. Now, I think beyond that, you have Trump doing what every authoritarian strongman in history has done. And I'm not saying that Trump is an authoritarian strongman, because he's not, but he is somebody who is borrowing tactics from them. And that is that anytime you have flagging poll numbers, your legislative agenda has stalled, you're unpopular, and you know you want to deflect blame, media and unpopular minority groups are the two things you go after. And this is the authoritarian strongman playbook 101. And Trump has done it to a T. He's demonized the press so many times that it's become routine. And this is, again, where the slow erosion of democracy gets normalized, because the first time that we saw him say fake news, it was big. It was a big story. Now it's just every day. I mean, almost every day he has an outburst where he calls fake news in reference to credible, well-sourced reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem with that is a lot of people believe it. So if you have an electorate of 160, 180 million people, you know, maybe 60 million people believe that NBC News and CNN are fake news. And that's completely toxic for a democracy to function. But it is much more sinister than that, and I think there are real parallels to be drawn here. I mean, the enemy of the people line that he tweeted out and then also said at the Conservative Political Action Conference, that is the exact same rhetoric that was used by Mao and Stalin and Chavez and some very ugly company, and it should never be said by an American president. So, you know, I think that the idea that anytime there's a critical report on Trump, it's fake, is an assault on truth itself. And you have this the same with one of the tweets he sent out where he said any bad polls are fake news, right? So anytime that there's a poll that shows him in a negative, anytime there's a story that shows him in a negative light, it's fake. That is terrible for democracy, because at its fundamental basis, democratic systems rely on informed consent of the governed. And the informed part is critical, because that's why Russia is not a democracy. It holds elections, but if all the information that voters get is state propaganda, it makes sense that they're going to see Putin in a positive light, and they do. So the media freedom and the idea that, you know, Trump has floated about taking away licenses, these are not partisan issues. This is a fundamentally democratic question, and it's something where, you know, 2 years ago, if somebody had even imagined floating that idea, it would have gotten universal bipartisan condemnation. And so it shows you, I think, the warping of democracy that Trump is able to do by galvanizing his supporters behind ideas that are fundamentally anti-democratic. Mm. And that's exactly what's happening with the demonization of the press. You know, I think that the press gets things wrong sometimes, but they're held to a standard where they must issue corrections.
Right.
And the president is not.
Yeah.
So, you know, the president is constantly making false claims, mm-hmm. And then does not correct them and repeats them. So I think this is something where we just have to have a new standard for journalism in the Trump era, where real-time fact-checking has to be applied in a way that was previously unnecessary, because we can no longer take for granted the good faith of the president in trying to be honest. The facts just belie that. So this aspect of Trump's presidency, I think, is one where it's extremely damaging, and it's a menace to American democracy, because poisoning the minds of those tens of millions of people against the press is not easy to undo. You can't just convince them that CNN is fine in 2 years or 3 years. So it's going to have much longer lasting effects than I think we even realize now.
To back up what you're saying, just 2 points about informed decision-making by government officials. In the White House, Stephen Miller, who's on the president's staff and is probably the most anti-immigrant of all of his advisors, refused to allow an assessment of the benefits of immigration. I think it was refugees. They were looking specifically at, you know, bringing refugees into the United States. What's the cost of that? Not what is the possible benefit of it. So he wanted that information just not considered. And then we saw on the FEMA website, briefly, information about the progress or lack of progress in Puerto Rico after the big hurricane. And then information was erased from the website. You know, I think you had an op-ed recently about how Orwellian Trump is, how he borrows from Orwell. And there are two examples of it.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I would categorize this under the broader heading of the politicization of nonpartisan institutions, including science and research.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Orwellian in the sense that it borrows from the Orwell's idea of Big Brother's memory hole in 1984, where you basically eliminate inconvenient facts and pretend that they never existed. So in addition to wiping the FEMA website of statistics that throw the response in a negative light, there's also all the deleted tweets that Trump had of his support for Luther Strange, who lost the Alabama Senate primary, because you know, Trump wants to have this view that he never backs a loser because he's such a winner himself.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, I think with the politicization of institutions, it's really damaging for government to make productive decisions, because things like research, scientific education, NASA, for example, are falling under a political rubric that forces us to question basic facts, which is really convenient for a government that wants to ignore them, right? But it's terrible for good democratic outcomes. So NASA, for example, Democrat, Republican, doesn't matter who the president was, the person appointed to head it was always somebody who had a deep and lasting expertise in the mission of the agency. The Trump appointee is a person who has no scientific background whatsoever and is a climate change denier, which is a real problem, given that NASA's part of NASA's portfolio is doing climate change research using, you know, space technologies. So any time that you have the politicization of what should be nonpartisan information, the government will start making decisions for the wrong reason. But it's also like the thing that I mentioned before, the Congressional Budget Office, this being politicized as well is problematic, because you can no longer trust information about what policies might produce, right? Mm-hmm. The same with the refugee study. Is it going to be beneficial or harmful to the American economy? And so at the point where that goes under the partisan rubric, then the existence of those partisan facts, if you will, combined with polarization of the electorate, is extremely damaging, because basically Republicans will believe a certain estimate, Democrats will believe another estimate, and there won't be any ground for compromise, because they'll fundamentally disagree on what a policy will do. And that's where you know, the congressional budget was conceived, for precisely this region, to have an independent arbiter of what facts are.
Right.
And the media is supposed to be this too. That's polarized and partisan now as well. So, you know, I think there's a really, really ugly future for American democracy if these things are not brought under control, because the politicians should be able to debate what the best solution is. They should not be able to determine whether or not there's a problem. And I think that, you know, when there are real, genuine problems like climate change that are just fundamentally swept under the rug or eliminated, for example, as they were from the White House website, eliminated from the EPA website, it's tossing our understanding of reality down this Orwellian memory hole. And democracy will follow if we're not more vigilant in making sure that we can at least agree across partisan lines on the value of basic research, science, and truth.
And facts, yeah. But some people would say, aren't we already there at a form of authoritarianism? I know we have a democracy and we all get to vote, but the lobbyists rule in Washington, Congress is fully compromised, it's in gridlock, the country's polarized, the wealthy rule, there's been a concentration of wealth in America now going on three decades or more. Wages, real wages for people have been stagnant for a while. So I could see where somebody would look upon this kind of pessimistically and say, well, you know, the plutocrats rule already. Aren't we already there?
Yeah, so I think that what you're referencing accurately is the how compromised some aspects of our democracy already are. There's no question they are. Before I get into some of the detail, I mean, I would say that I still think that Americans have a meaningful say in how they're governed when you compare it to genuinely authoritarian countries. Mm-hmm. Right? Elections do actually matter. The number of votes cast actually matters. And that is something that actually is extremely rare in the world. So, you know, yes, we have serious problems, but we're still, you know, in comparative terms, doing very well in democracy terms. That being said, the failures of democracy to represent the people's interests, I think there's basically two major silver bullets that need to be fired. And one of them is districting reform and gerrymandering, so and creating competitive elections on the one hand, and the other is money and politics. So with gerrymandering, I went back and I looked at 2016 results for the House. You know, 435 seats at play. Eight incumbents lost. Eight. Right?
Wow.
So
yeah.
Almost all of the incumbents that ran were reelected. And the average margin of victory, I calculated, was 37.1% in those races.
Wow.
Which is what you expect to see in, you know, in a sham election in Russia. Because mm-hmm. That means that the average person is winning about 70-30, right? So like 68-30-31 or whatever, 32. And so this is something where that completely compromises the integrity of our democracy. Because any time that the elections are a foregone conclusion, people don't even care. They don't vote. And that's why you have in 2014, the turnout for the congressional midterms in 2014 was just over 36%, which I've served as an election monitor in sub-Saharan Africa. And a lot of times, if that type of turnout exists in those countries, we would say it's an illegitimate election because the population didn't participate in any meaningful way. So I think that's a real red flag to worry about. And gerrymandering also, when you have these uncompetitive elections, it creates greater polarization within Congress, because if you know that the only way you're going to lose is if you have a primary challenger, because you're winning 70-30 in every general election, the only thing that makes sense to do is to never compromise, because it just means that the harder line Republican or the harder line Democrat will run against you in the primary. And that's what we're seeing. That's why, you know, and Steve Bannon is doing this already with the Republicans, and I'm sure there will be, from the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, many primary challenges as well. So, you know, that gets more extreme views, then people become more extreme in response to their representatives, and, you know, sort of the spiral continues. And the other aspect, as I said, is money and politics. And so, you know, I think there is a real problem with how rich you have to get elected, and there's also a real problem with how much time you have to spend raising money, and there's a real problem with how much lobbyist influence there is. And so there's been a study from Princeton that showed effectively that well-financed interests have fairly responsive representatives, so that, in other words, Congress responds to those who spend money, mm-hmm. and for the average person, they're very non-responsive. So we need to deal with these problems, but it is still worth pointing out that we can deal with them, right? There's still a democratic way to reform the system, and that's what separates us out from more authoritarian contexts, because once the system is completely compromised and there's no way to have recourse, that's when authoritarianism sticks. And the places where I've, you know, done research, it's like, how are they going to overthrow a military government? It's much, much more difficult once you go down that road. So, you know, I think the problem is urgent, that we need to have reform, but we're still a solid democracy in comparative terms.
Just one last thing, Brian. I'm eager to ask you for a personal perspective, being based in London, taking the global view of things, but participating in the U.S. news media here for commentary and analysis of Trump. But what do you hear from people in London? What do people in the U.K. say about all this? The people you have contact with, have coffee with, or tea? What do they make of Trump and what's been happening here?
I genuinely wish that more Americans had a chance to talk politics with the rest of the world, because the fundamental assumption in every, not just the UK, but in my travels in Eastern Europe and Southeast Asia and Africa, people I talk to is, how did this happen? You know, I mean, there's a different premise even in media questions in the UK, where people have sort of started from the default position of, okay, so this person is clearly not fit to be president. What do we do with that information, and how do we deal with it and contain the risk, right? Which is obviously very different from the framing of questions you get in the U.S. And I cannot overestimate how much damage has been done to America's reputation in global diplomacy, in how people see the U.S. I've had people ask me, you know, do you think it's safe to travel to America in the Trump administration? You know, the aspects with mass shootings, et cetera, have contributed to that. But there are people who say, I was going to go to a conference in America, but I've heard that there's much more racial profiling at the borders. I don't want to come. And also, people just don't think that any country that could elect this person is a serious player in global diplomacy and has the same values as Europe. So, you know, I mean, I obviously try to straddle the line between both American politics and also debates in British politics and Europe more generally, but the worldview of Trump is very negative, and there's hard data to back this up. I mean, Pew did a survey looking at confidence in American leadership between Obama and Trump. It's fallen already in the first 6 months of his time in the White House. It fell 75% in Germany, 70% in France, similar numbers in South Korea and Japan, 57% in the UK. The only two countries that have seen an increase in confidence in U.S. leadership are, you can guess one of them, Russia, where it went up by 42%, and also a small spike in Israel. So, you know, when you're living outside the United States, the debate about Trump is not, is this a good thing? It's, how do we deal with this disaster? And, you know, people can take issue, obviously, with my own personal biases the way I see this. But this is just how the rest of the world sees America right now. And there's hard data to back it up, and I can speak from anecdotal experience that it's definitely like that over here.
Well, Brian, it's been nice to get you on the podcast. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Brian Klass, that's K-L-A-A-S, is an American political commentator and author with a specialty in authoritarianism, foreign policy, political violence, and elections. He is the author of The Despot's Apprentice, Donald Trump's Attack on Democracy, and earlier, The Despot's Accomplice, How the West is Aiding and Abetting the Decline of Democracy. We spoke with him in London, where he is a fellow in comparative politics at the London School of Economics. And that's our show for now, episode 311. Today marks 2 years since the first episode of Roughly Speaking, which was on October 19th, 2015. Filmmaker John Waters was our guest for the first show. Thanks to everyone who's listened to the program and supported it. A special thanks to the staff here at the Baltimore Sun, the editors, the managers, the publisher, and of course our sponsor, the Ivy Bookshop, for making all of this possible. For producers Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and Christina Tasek, this is Dan Rodericks here at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Please review the show on iTunes if you get a chance, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.